This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Like most of life's major events or crises, the emotional and mental labour is taxing enough without having to learn the intricacies of a whole new system you've never dealt with before. Just like being thrown in at the deep end in a medical emergency or buying your first home, we could all use a heads up about how these processes work before we need them. Episode 3 of Tell Me Moya is all about breaking down the ins and outs of our family court system and looking at the options and support services that are available to couples navigating a separation. Welcome to Tell Me Moya, where the chats are candid, the laughs are loud, and nothing is off limits. I'm Harriet Moya, and each episode I'm sitting down with brilliant women for no filter and no nonsense chats about, well, pretty much anything. Season 2 of Tell Me Moya is a series of conversations that dig into the nitty-gritty and need-to-knows of separation, divorce, custody issues, relationship property, and family harm. Tell Me Moya dives right into the conversations we want to have but don't have time for, and the ones we don't want to have but we know we should. Are you ready for Tell Me Moya? In this week's episode, we are hoping to demystify some of the legal frameworks and decode some of the legal jargon of the family court, and also share details about the processes, support groups, organisations and social services that are available for couples during this often very fraught and tender process. And I'm so lucky today to have three wonderful and very knowledgeable women and industry professionals in the studio with me to share their knowledge about family law and what it all means and how it all works. Welcome to all three of you today. So first of all, I've got Rochelle Crossman, who is an extremely successful local specialist family law barrister. For 25 years, Rochelle has helped clients with all aspects of family law, including relationship, property division and care of children. Rochelle has been appointed by the Dunedin Family Court to act for children as a lawyer for child since 2010. From her early professional years to a stint in the UK working in the child protection sphere and her current work as a barrister sole, Rochelle helps her clients resolve their legal issues through informed decision making and supporting them wherever possible to reach agreement without needing a court hearing. Rochelle is also trained in the collaborative process and is currently the Dunedin representative for the New Zealand Law Society Family Law Section. And lucky for me, she's the sponsor of Tell Me Moya Season 2. Welcome, Rochelle.
Oh, thanks, Harriet.
Yeah, nice to have you. Nice to see you. And Stephanie Pettigrew is also in the studio today, and she's a prominent New Zealand lawyer and a director at Marks & Worth Lawyers, an all-female boutique law firm based in Aotearoa, Dunedin. Working within the legal industry since 2003, Stephanie specialises in family law dispute resolution, where she works as an accredited mediator and collaborative law specialist to resolve family disputes out of court, and also with wills and estates. Stephanie is trained in collaborative law and is a member of a Collaborative Resolution NZ, and she is also on the panel of lawyers in Otago who are appointed by the family court to represent individuals who do not have the mental capacity to make decisions for themselves regarding their property or their personal care and welfare. Stephanie is a member of the New Zealand Institute of Directors and has been the chair of Presbyterian Support Otago since 2023. So a very warm welcome to you, Stephanie. Thank you for being here.
Kia ora, Harriet.
Thank you for having me. Rochelle is also here.
And kia ora, Rochelle.
And my third lovely guest in the studio today is Rachel Grant. So Rachel practiced law for over 10 years before transitioning to a career focused on mediation, conflict coaching and legal education. She's an accredited mediator and conflict coach with Resolution Institute and contracts to Blue Door Mediation. Rachel also teaches professional legal studies to law students and delivers workshops on dispute resolution and communication. In addition, she volunteers as a mediator with the Dunedin Community Mediation. So a warm welcome to you also, Rachel. It's a treat for me to have three people in studio today to chat with. 56 minutes never seems like long enough. So thank you all for being here. Now, Rochelle, Stephanie and Rachel are all here today to answer questions questions and dispel myths around family law. However, these women are not your lawyer and this is not legal advice. So please be sure to speak to a lawyer about your specific situation. Right, let's get stuck in to this conversation. I thought to begin with it would be a really good idea to have a brief overview of family law as it stands in New Zealand. So I'm going to throw to you off the bat, Rochelle, to maybe quickly summarise as briefly as you can a very complex matter. What is family law in New Zealand? Like, what does that, and what does that encompass? Like, what sort of issues does that deal with?
Yeah, so the family court deals with lots of different issues, but the big one is care of children. So that's the one we see most often. So if couples split up and they can't work out what the care arrangements should be for their children, then the family court can help with that. Probably the next biggest thing that the family court deals with is family violence. So again, if you're facing family violence, then the court can make orders to help with that. Next, I would say relationship property. So the division of your property after you separate and other aspects of the law relating to property, including prenuptial agreements or contracting out agreements. So that comes within family law. And then there are things that we don't see quite so often, but paternity, that can be an issue, adoption and surrogacy, for example. And triple PR, which Stephanie will be able to tell us what that even stands for.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Triple PR.
So the Protection of Personal and Property Rights Act, which is the law that governs adults who don't have the mental capacity to make decisions for themselves.
Right, okay.
Either as a result of injury or long-term disability.
And that comes under the family law
that
umbrella.
That comes under the family law umbrella. So the family court can make orders appointing somebody else to be a guardian of an adult who doesn't have capacity to make decisions for themselves or to manage their property.
Yes, that's wonderful that that exists. It's very important, I imagine. Yes.
Yeah, so the family court doesn't exclusively help people who are separating. It does. Mm. It does.
Yes, yes, because that would be like, that's what my impression would have been, yeah, because I see here that it's also estates and changes to wills and
so
things as well.
Broadly, family disputes under what we call the Family Protection Act. If a family member feels that they've been left out of a will, they can bring a claim in the family court.
Okay.
Against the estate as well.
Okay.
So it deals broadly with family property as well as family relationships.
Yes. Okay. Okay. Right. So that's like a real overview. So if there were some like core tenets of the family court or some like desired outcomes, I mean, some of those are quite different angles, of course, or different situations. But, you know, if the family court may well have a mission statement, does it? I don't know. But if the family court had a mission statement, what would it be?
It has its own act of parliament.
Yes, well, it does. Look, if the court is looking at anything to do with children, then the best interests of the children are paramount. So that is the number one if children are relevant. So it's what is their best interests. And when it comes to property, for example, the Act says, you know, we want to be able to divide property efficiently, simply,
fairly
in a cost-effective way.
And we'll be talking about that in episode 4, talking all about money. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. So the family court is meant to be less formal than other courts. There is still a lot of formality there, but certainly less formal.
Formal, but really high stakes, I would say. Like, less formal, but way more emotional. That's interesting. I wonder if that's because it's more about, like, a human experience, so it's less formal. Is that...
It's also a specialist court, so family court judges are all specialists in these areas of family law, as opposed to a district court judge who may have come from different areas of law. Judges have to have a special licence to be a family court judge and have that specialist expertise.
Okay, and what could that look like? Like, in order to become a family law judge? what the types of things
they will have worked. They will have done family court work throughout their careers.
Yes.
Yeah. Usually been a lawyer for child.
It's not like a special course that you do on Weet-Bix packets or something like that can get you in there. Okay, right, okay. Yeah, all right. And like as a percentage of cases in general, family law cases, how many end up in the family court, do you reckon?
I don't keep statistics.
Might be a bit depressing.
Probably depends on the lawyer.
Yeah, true. And look, one thing I do say to clients is actually the vast majority of parents who separate don't need to go to court, and many don't even see a lawyer. I mean, for an awful lot of people, they're able to resolve it completely on their own.
Yeah.
So already as lawyers, we're seeing a subgroup of people who have separated, and then out of that, there's another subgroup who have to go to court. And then out of that, there's a very small number who actually need a judge to impose a decision
go
on
to
them.
A hearing. Yeah, right. That's what I was going to say. That's what I had heard, is that the general... the pathways and everything in place are all about ultimately trying to keep people out of court, right?
And empowering people to make decisions that are right for them and their family.
Yes, and also because cost.
Yes.
Okay. Right. Okay. So speaking of pathways to ending up or avoiding ending up in court, I think that's a really good point to make, actually, because somebody going into a separation may just assume that they will go to court, that that's just part of what happens. So it's quite good to get that out there, I think, that there is, that's actually a minority situation. Yeah, and we're about to explore some of the options that are available to you.
Can I just butt in there, because that's a myth I'd really like to dispel, that just going to see a lawyer doesn't mean that you're going to go to court, and it doesn't mean that you're going to be really nasty to your ex either. It's about educating yourself.
Empowering yourself.
So it always saddens me when people are frightened to even go and see a lawyer. We're here to help and we want to give you advice.
Yes, and I think there's all, as you say, there's an assumption that if you're engaging a lawyer, then you're going down this big pathway to something really serious and expensive. But people can also just engage lawyers for parts of the process, can't they?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I would say go and see a lawyer early on and research who your lawyer is going to be. Find one who is going to want to keep you out of court and just give you some really good advice.
Yes. And we are specifically talking about relatively straightforward situations as a general consensus. There will be exceptions to these things, and we'll talk a little bit about that later, and we'll delve into that even more perhaps in the episodes 5 and 6 later in the series. So, yeah. Okay, so options before you end up having to go to court, or hopefully options to help you avoid ending up in the courtroom. So good old straight out round the dining room table negotiation. Right? Stephanie, do you want to tell us like maybe just a quick definition and maybe some of the advantages and disadvantages of what a good old fashioned negotiation could look like?
A negotiation is a two-way conversation, and it is, I think, as Rochelle said, how the majority of family law disputes are resolved, and often with the assistance of lawyers, maybe writing letters, maybe having a roundtable meeting. But it's the parties coming, whether they're bringing their interests or their positions, but trying to reach an agreement, and negotiating on their various differences to reach agreement, which the lawyers can then help them record in writing.
Yeah.
And I would say of my work, more than half of my work is resolved through sort of good old fashioned negotiation.
That's awesome.
You know, conversations, maybe letters and emails between lawyers, bit of phone calls. But it's working it out, finding out what both parties want and negotiating to find a solution that works.
And to be clear, this is about both parenting agreements and relationship property, probably
as well. And estates.
Yeah.
And incapacity disputes.
Yeah.
Across the board. Any dispute can be resolved by negotiation if the parties are willing to negotiate.
Yes.
And if they're willing to negotiate in good faith.
Yes. Yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So the advantages of that are that it's cheaper.
If it's done efficiently and
well,
negotiations can certainly be drawn out.
Yeah, sure.
And then if lawyers are charging on a time basis, that can get expensive. But it's generally always going to be cheaper than going to court.
Okay, yeah. Potential disadvantages?
Parties may get worn down and may end up agreeing to something that isn't right.
In their best interest.
We often see that people just get to a point where they want it over.
Yes.
And so the person with the stronger negotiating power can quote unquote win.
Yes.
Whereas you haven't got the protections perhaps of the court and a judge saying, well, actually no, that's not right.
Yeah.
Okay. Hopefully the lawyers would be advising people not to agree to something that isn't right. But ultimately that is probably the biggest risk.
Okay, yeah. Mm. All right, and so now we're going to hear from Rachel. So, Rachel, mediation. Okay, there's perhaps a little bit of clarification required around mediation. So we have mediation and then there's FDR. So what can you tell us what FDR is and versus mediation and maybe what the distinction is between those two things?
Yes, so FDR is a type of mediation. Mediation can occur, can be helpful in all sorts of disputes. So family law disputes, you may hear about, even international peace talks can involve mediation. So mediation is just a structured conversation between two parties, similar to negotiation, but you have a neutral third party who is facilitating the process and helping the parties to really understand each other's perspectives and explore options and then come up with their own agreement. So similar to negotiation, you can have lawyers involved. Often in the family context, there may not be lawyers in the room. So FDR is a government run program where free mediation is available to people who are having issues around care of children.
Yes. FDR specific to care of children, isn't it?
Yeah. So if you're wanting to resolve relationship property issues, for example, or estate issues, FDR is not available, but it is available for care of children.
Yep.
It's not just co-parents, so it may be a wider family as well, whānau who may have issues around care of children.
Mm-hmm.
So the theory is really that it's the parents, the whānau, who know best what's in the best interests of the child rather than a judge. But often families just need assistance to come up with an agreement themselves.
Yes.
Sorry, family dispute resolution. And really the family court doesn't have the time to deal with issues around, you know, where Johnny's going to spend Christmas Day. It's better for those kind of issues to be resolved in FDR. So the government provides 12 free hours of FDR to help resolve these disputes. And that's available every 12 months. So that might
So it can be recurring.
It can be recurring, yeah. Okay. So it might be that you've just separated and you want support to come up with a parenting plan with your ex-partner. Or it may be some years down the track when you can't decide what school to send your child to. Yes. And so you might want to access mediation then.
Okay.
So you may want to go to a lawyer beforehand and get some legal advice. Or during the process you could ask for legal advice. But generally lawyers won't be part of that process.
Yes, and actually I can give a really good example of mediation working well because we'd been 5 years already-ish, 50-50 with the kids, and we were on like a 3-3-4-4 arrangement, but those days were always the pickups and drop-offs were weekend days, and my ex wanted to switch to week-about, which I believe that the children weren't ready for, And the pickups and drop-offs were becoming really harrowing.
Mm.
The kids were didn't want to go. Mm. Lots of tears, tantrums, screaming, thumping, all of it. And so we went to mediation to talk about all of that. And actually we came up with a really great solution, mm. and I was not expecting to at all.
Yeah.
So we ended up with like a 5-5-5-2-2-5 thing, so that mm. the handovers were not happening on, they were happening on school days.
Mm.
And it was like, oh, yeah. It was just like this kind of revelation, yes. actually. So it yeah. was really helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stephanie was talking about positions and interests. So often a couple might, people will often have these really fixed positions. You know, one parent wants to send their kid to the Catholic private school and the other one wants the public school, and you think it's going to be this battle between A and B. Whereas a mediator's role is to really uncover why is it that one parent wants this? And if yeah. you're not communicating well with your ex, you can, it's very easy to jump to assumptions about
yes.
why they're saying X and not Y. The mediator's role, and this often happens in the individual sessions which come before the joint session. So
yeah.
the mediator will meet with you one-on-one and talk you through what you're thinking, what is it that you hope to achieve, mm-hmm. and also the why. Why is it that you're seeking this specific outcome? And it's often not necessarily there can be a broad range of reasons why someone wants a particular outcome. And, you know, in the case of the school, you might think it's, you know, one parent's religious and the other's not. But when you ask those questions, it turns out that maybe there's an element of cost involved, or,
yeah,
you know, maybe one parent likes yeah. the Catholic school because it has a great music program.
Yeah.
And so that opens up a whole lot of options.
Yeah.
So the question doesn't become, is it school A or school B? The question becomes, how do we provide great musical tuition for our child while giving them
yeah.
exposure to the Christian faith? And,
sure.
you know, it opens
yeah.
up a whole lot more kind of questions and options for the
yes.
couple to deal with.
And I think you mentioned it briefly. So the mediator isn't actually making decisions, are
no.
they?
So
it's
no.
Yeah, that's important, I think,
yes.
to know.
So they're not a judge.
Yeah.
They're not there to give recommendations or to give advice. They're really there to support the parties to express themselves to each other and to explore options. They will do sort of reality testing. So if the couple says, you know, we've decided that Johnny's going to go to 3 events on Christmas Day, they might be like, well, hang on, what happens when Johnny has a meltdown at lunchtime?
Yes, like, sure, yeah.
So they will, they can.
A voice of reason.
Yes,
sometimes,
yeah.
yeah. And another last question. When is mediation perhaps not an appropriate option?
Yeah. So the mediator will do some screening before they agree to go ahead with a mediation. So if there's been a history of domestic violence, abuse, mediation may not be appropriate. There's no blanket rule that says that if there has been domestic violence that you can't mediate. So
right.
it will definitely be a case-by-case process. But if the power imbalance is such that it's not safe for one person to be able to really voice themselves
yes,
and feel
sure.
like they can make a decision, you know, safely in that context
yeah.
with the other person, that may not be appropriate.
Now, sometimes do they have to take a person's word for that as opposed to there being evidence of that, if that makes sense? Like if a person comes in and says, I have experienced these things with this person, there's not a recorded history of DV or whatever. Is that something, does the mediator then, do you know what I'm asking? Does it make sense what I'm asking? It's just like, obviously
yeah.
if someone has a record of DV mm. or something, but often there will be those situations where that stuff isn't on record,
mm.
but the other party is still really, really vulnerable in that situation.
Mm.
And really all they can do is tell you that they are.
Yeah, I think it would be up to the individual mediator and the way that
yes.
they screen
okay.
as to the immediate, particularly in the FDR context, a mediator can just write an outcome. They can just say that they don't think that mediation is appropriate
yeah.
in this case, and then that person can go straight to the
yeah.
family court.
Okay.
But many couples, the family court will tell them that they need to try FDR
yes.
at the start.
Okay.
But certainly for some couples, that's not appropriate.
Thank you so much, Rachel. We're just going to hear a word from our sponsor.
Going through a separation? you don't have to face it alone. Rochelle Crossman is a specialist family law barrister, helping clients move forward with clarity and care. She focuses on collaborative resolution of the issues that arise from separation, from relationship property division to care arrangements for children, keeping matters respectful and out of court where possible. But when court is required, she's there to advocate strongly. Find a better path forward. Find out more at rochellecrossman.co.nz.
Well, I've actually even got Rochelle Crossman just sitting in the studio with me. It feels like I'm with a celebrity. Thank you for sponsoring this season, Rochelle. Really appreciate it. So that we've just talked a bit about mediation with Rachel. Thank you, Rachel. And we're going to switch now to talk about the collaborative process. And Stephanie's going to dive in here, even though you both, all of you have experience in this area, actually. So feel free to dive in. So just a brief nutshell about what the collaborative process is, perhaps even compared to mediation?
Absolutely, yeah. And look, I fully expect Rochelle to jump in here because this is, we are collaborative. And, yes, and we will share our experience.
Exactly.
Having said that, the collaborative dispute resolution process is a defined legal process. I think a lot of lawyers will talk about that they're collaborative, which means, you know, we work nicely together. But the collaborative dispute resolution process is a legal process that has been used around the world really for over 25 years now. It was developed in America by an employment lawyer originally who thought there has to be a better way to resolve disputes.
Is it also known by its acronym?
CDR? Not really. It's more known as collaborative dispute. We put a capital C on the collaborative. But the process is, I would say, almost a cross between mediation and negotiation. It's an interests-based negotiation process where you've got a collaborative team of the parties to the dispute and their legal advisors. You'll often have a facilitator who's a neutral party. You will bring in specialist advisors. So in a family law context, that might be financial advisors, the accountant, it might be a parenting coach. So the professionals and the parties work together as a collaborative team to identify what are the important issues for this family and how can we resolve the legal disputes for this family in a way that actually meets the interests of both parties.
Yeah,
so
okay.
it's trying to find a win-win rather than a lose-lose solution. What's really important in the collaborative dispute resolution process is that from the very outset, the parties sign a participation agreement.
Okay.
And that gives a legal framework to the process.
Okay.
So that differentiates it from just your sort of standard negotiation kind of process. And one of the rules in that participation agreement is that the threat of litigation will not be used at all in the process.
Okay.
So often in family negotiation, where we call it litigation almost, we're saying, look, this is what I'm going to do, and if you don't agree, then I'm going to file in family court.
Yes. Takes that
in,
off
in
the
collaborative
table.
Dispute resolution, right. That is not allowed. You can't do that. So the dispute resolution process is then run through a series of meetings with the collaborative team. And the idea is that what happens in those meetings stays in those meetings. They're fully confidential and they're completely without prejudice. And so not having that threat of litigation means that people can actually be transparent. They can put forward solutions or proposals that might go against their interests or go against what a family court might order, but might actually be what's best for their family.
Yeah.
It allows for a free flow of real conversation and problem solving.
And do you find that it does that?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
That's so interesting.
And so one of the other rules that the parties sign up to in the participation agreement is that the lawyers involved in the collaborative process, if it fails, they cannot represent those parties in court
because they've already got.
Yeah.
preconceptions.
Yes, and it also, that's to protect, again, that without prejudice yes. nature of the conversations yeah. that happen
okay.
in that space. Hmm. And likewise, if other professionals are involved, if there's a financial advisor, they will sign up to the participation agreement as well, and they could not then be called as a witness
okay.
in the family court later
yeah.
if the process failed.
Okay, I see. I did not understand that. About yeah. the process. So that's yeah. really interesting.
And the process is then run, this is where it comes a little bit more like a mediation. It's run through a structured meeting format where you have almost like a committee meeting. You've got an agenda. The meetings are only go for 2 hours maximum.
Yep.
Minutes are taken.
Because sometimes you can sit in mediation for days, can't you?
Yeah.
Not my mediation.
Yeah, don't. No. Yeah. Okay, yeah. good. Right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. The science is that nobody's making good decisions after 2 hours.
Yeah.
And these are intense situations. You're sitting in a room with your ex,
yeah.
who you potentially yeah. may not have been sitting in a room with for a long time.
Yeah.
Having really full on conversations about matters of the heart and, you know, matters that are really, really important to you financially.
Yeah.
And so yeah, we keep the meetings to 2 hours.
Yeah.
And that keeps them productive.
Yeah.
And so at the end of each meeting, then everyone goes away with a list of homework. You commit in the participation agreement that you'll be timely in actually doing the tasks
yep.
or getting the information that you need to do between the meetings. And we sort of set the agenda for the next meeting so that it keeps the process
moving along. What happens if somebody doesn't do those things? Like, what happens if somebody doesn't keep it confidential or doesn't, yeah?
I've found working with a facilitator has been amazing.
Yeah.
So in the earlier days in Dunedin, we didn't use a facilitator, but now we have that available to us.
Yeah.
And she keeps everybody on track.
Okay.
So it's really good.
And it's off your hands.
Yeah, as lawyers, it means we don't have to be chasing up our clients. Yes. Have you done their homework yet?
Right.
Have you found that bank statement yet? So she does that. But I mean, to answer your ultimate question, I mean, collaboration will fail if parties don't do what they need to do.
Yes.
But,
okay.
The team will jolly them along.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And the other thing is everything is being recorded. It's minuted. So the team, there's sort of that sense of accountability as well.
Yes, sure.
That you're showing up, you're committing to do these things, and you're sort of letting yourself down as well as everyone else if you don't.
Yeah.
One of the other features of the collaborative process, which is agreed to in the participation agreement, is there's no correspondence or negotiation or lawyers' letters being exchanged outside of the meeting. So everything happens in the meetings.
Yeah, okay.
And that's actually really important because as lawyers, you know, we love to write a good letter setting out why the other party's client has been bad and done all these things.
Yeah.
And you know, and we've all seen the flip side of that, when your client receives a letter like that, it can be really hurtful or damaging. Or we say things in a lawyer's letter that we don't recognise necessarily the impact of that on
the recipient of
that letter. And so in the collaborative process, we just take all of those kind of nasty letters out.
Yeah.
And again, everything happens in the meetings.
Yeah.
Everything is
really transparent,
sort of transparent and formally recorded.
It does sound awesome.
And really efficient. It is awesome. I absolutely love it. And I mean, my long-term goal will be to do only collaborative process.
Right.
Because it's much nicer for us as lawyers.
Mm, sure.
And I was going to say, it's much more efficient too. Because, you know, I could write a letter and send it to Stephanie, and then she's got to send it to her client, and then she's got to take instructions and then come back to me.
Yeah.
And I mean, I've written letters about a lawnmower. Who's going to keep the lawnmower and how much is it worth? And that's 3 weeks of waiting. In a collaborative meeting, you're sitting there, you say, who's going to keep the lawnmower? Oh, Bob wants it. That's cool. Okay, done.
Yeah, sure.
Mm. And we don't get into arguments about why you didn't put enough oil in the lawnmower in the first place.
Yeah, that's right.
It's
Is it expensive as an option? Like, is there funding available for it? Mm. Can you get financial assistance for it? Because
awesome. Unfortunately, no, there's no legal aid available for collaborative at the moment. That is something that there's a national kind of committee of collaborative lawyers who have tried to work on that, but yeah. At present there's no legal aid. There is funding. Have you talked about Just Fund on the podcast yet, Rochelle?
I think
I haven't.
No. Okay,
So there are some options. There is a family law fund funding service available now in New Zealand called Just Fund.
Okay.
Which can, it's essentially a finance company that can lend money to clients for completing family law processes. That can certainly be used for collaborative.
Yeah.
If the parties are eligible for it. But coming back to your question of, is collaborative expensive? It's, I would say, not as expensive as litigation.
That's what I was going to say.
Much
more efficient.
But it's not cheap either.
Yes, of course.
So you are using specialist trained lawyers. Obviously, and if you've got a facilitator, you're paying for the facilitator. So there's a time commitment there. But then, as Rochelle said, it's much more efficient as well, because we're not spending 3 hours writing a letter about a lawnmower. We're setting an agenda. We're coming together. We often get through more in those 2 hours than we might get through in 2 months of exchanging letters.
I can appreciate that,
And then when you think about the family court timeframes, and Rochelle's going to talk about that soon, I'm sure, the backlog in the family court and the time it takes even to get to a settlement conference, we can have a collaborative process over and done with in 3 months.
Yeah, sure.
On relatively complex files as well. So one of the other things you commit to in the process once it starts is that it keeps going. So ideally,
until it's resolved.
It's resolved. So ideally you would be meeting every 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So it's kind of keeping that momentum happening. And making sure that you're bringing in the right people, getting the support in.
Yep.
So you might not have the accountant at every meeting. They might only come to the meeting that's relevant.
Yeah, sure.
But the other great thing about that is that one accountant or one financial advisor comes and advises the whole team rather than both parties going off and spending
getting their own separate accounting
advice.
Honestly, it does. It sounds so good.
Yeah, we love it.
Collaborative process, people.
Yeah.
Do it. And mediation, also wonderful. And I have, in general terms of my separation and whatever, most of it is really negative, but I can say that mediation process was something that was quite positive and well structured and sort of, it was great. Yeah.
Can I add to that? I 100% it's the better way. And as Rochelle said, for us as lawyers, it's so much nicer to work with that. I think the thing that's important to remember, though, is that it is still a legal process, and it's not going to solve the underlying, it's not a counselling or therapeutic process.
Yes.
And it's not going to take away the hurt.
Yes, of course.
And one of the things that in the collaborative process, often a bit like a mediation, we always start the first meeting with the parties bring a pre-prepared statement of what's important to them.
Yeah.
And they read that to each other. And it's so brave and such a massive thing.
Huge.
People may not have been speaking for
Might not have been in the same room.
May not have been in the same room. And I know both Rochelle and I have been in the room when people have been reading their statements to each other and we're sitting there trying to hold back the tears.
Yeah.
Mm. What's often really beautiful is that people who, have been in this conflict come in and then say exactly the same thing to each other.
Yeah. Mm. Oh,
they
gosh.
Both want the same thing, easy example, if it's your kids, they both say, I want us to be great co-parents for our kids, or I want our kids to have, a good life. And it's really powerful for them to hear that
from each other.
Mm. But it's really we shouldn't underestimate how hard that is for people to do.
Yeah.
And also to hear from your ex then to truly listen.
Yeah.
So part of the process is actually about listening to each other and then working together with the support of your professional team to actually try and problem solve. Mm.
Incredibly powerful.
Incredibly powerful. Yeah. But not don't not easy.
Yes.
So not to be sort of underestimated as the easy option.
I think particularly in New Zealand, we have a bit of a conflict avoidance as a culture. We're not used to saying things to people directly.
Totally.
We, you know, if you get in conflict with someone, people would rather, you know, just run from it or hide than actually say that to someone's face. And so actually having to sit across a table with someone and talking about these really hard things, I think for Kiwis in particular, is really, really hard.
Yeah. I agree. And also sounds like it takes away that threat of litigation.
Yeah.
Because that's terrifying for people because we don't understand what happens in court or in those processes. Mm. And we all see big scary dollar signs and all of those things. So just taking away that fear for people. Yeah.
And I'd also just like to say the collaborative process, while it's being used really effectively, particularly here in Dunedin and across New Zealand, in the family. Traditional family, as in parenting and relationship property space. It is also used, it's used around the world in a wide variety of disputes. Any dispute, again, where there may be an ongoing relationship, whether that's shareholders in a business, but also in Australia, and we're hoping to get more of this happening in New Zealand, family estate disputes and trusts.
Yeah.
If you think about, you know, disputing spouses coming around the table and talking, disputing siblings over mum or dad's estate, it's exactly the same, or not exactly the same, but it's the same kind of emotions.
Yeah.
And you're working through matters of the heart as well as legal issues.
Totally.
And it's a perfect process for those kind of disputes to be worked out.
Yeah, okay.
In a private, dignified,
dignified is a great word.
Formal,
yes,
way. That allows the real issues to be explored.
Yeah, so I wonder why it's just new in Dunedin.
Well, in New Zealand. We're leading it in New Zealand, I think, here in Dunedin.
Awesome.
But it has been around for a decade or more.
Yeah.
It does, it makes a lot of sense.
We're just going to hear another ad.
Going through a separation? You don't have to face it alone. Rochelle Crossman is a specialist family law barrister, helping clients move forward with clarity and care. She focuses on collaborative resolution of the issues that arise from separation, from relationship property division to care arrangements for children, keeping matters respectful and out of court where possible. But when court is required, she's there to advocate strongly. Find a better path forward. Find out more at rochellecrossman.co.nz.
Thank you, Rochelle, for sponsoring season two of Tell Me Moya. And we are going to turn to you now, Rochelle, and ask you some questions now about what happens when we do end up in the family court in the litigation process. So, like, when does this, what sort of some examples of when this actually becomes necessary?
Yeah, so the family court, the overwhelming number of applications to the family court are about children. So it's when people either have recently separated or may have been separated for a very long time and can't agree on arrangements for their children.
Yeah.
That along with family violence applications as well. Now, if I talk briefly about family violence, I mean, if somebody is in a abusive situation, then probably mediation, collaboration and even negotiation aren't going to be options.
Yep,
so,
absolutely.
You know, if you are a victim of family violence, then yes, you are probably going to need to go to family court and make an application for a protection order.
Okay.
If you feel that you need that protection.
Yeah.
So I think you're doing a whole episode on that, are you?
We're doing, there's a couple of episodes.
Right, okay. Yeah, so I won't go any more into that now.
Sure. Yep.
Yeah. But if we put the family violence aside, then somebody who's separated who simply can't make arrangements for their children may have to end up in the family court.
Yes, okay.
And they would apply for a parenting order and the court will deal with that process. It takes a long time.
Yeah, okay. And when you say that process, like
let's
break down of what are the elements of that process. Like, Like, how does it start?
How does it even start?
Yeah, what happens next, and then next, and then next,
Okay, so the applicant is the person who makes the application, so you're applying to the court, and, you know, it's pieces of paper, your lawyer will draw that up, or you can go onto the website, and there are forms there for people who can who don't want to have a lawyer or who can't have a lawyer. So you can apply to the family court without a lawyer. I wouldn't recommend it, but some people need to do that. So you make your application and you set out in that what it is that you want. For example, you might say, I want to have week about shared care, or you might be saying, I want to have full care of my children because the other person is unsafe.
Yeah.
So, or anything in between.
Yeah.
You file that application along with an affidavit. So an affidavit is your narrative. It's your story.
Yep.
You'll either swear it on the Bible or make a non-religious affirmation, but it has to be completely true and correct. You know, technically it's perjury if you tell a lie in your affidavit.
Yes.
Those documents will then be processed by the court and served on the other party. So the whoever it is that you're taking to court, usually the other parent, they then get a copy of those documents and they get the opportunity to respond.
Okay.
They will then file their response with their narrative affidavit. Usually, almost always, certainly in Dunedin, the court will then appoint a lawyer to act for the children.
Yes.
The child or the children.
Okay, important. We'll go into a bit more depth about lawyer for child in season 7 and 8.
Good.
Episode 7 and 8.
So lawyer for child will meet with the children. We have to. You know, the law says we have to meet with our client as lawyer for child. They may or may not speak to the parents. And we'll do a report to the court. And typically, again, certainly in Dunedin, where we do work very well together as lawyers, lawyer for child will usually suggest a meeting.
Yeah.
So we call that a round table meeting.
Yes.
I don't know if it's because the table itself is round or whether it's because we're sitting around the table. I actually don't know.
Both of those things.
Very often the table is not round. Mm-hmm. But at that point, then you're getting back into that negotiation. So it's not mediation, but the lawyer for child will be there and will try and get the people to reach some sort of an agreement.
Yep.
If lawyer for child can't weave his or her magic and make that happen, then usually the next step in Care of Children Act proceedings will be a settlement conference with a judge.
Right, a
settlement conference, yes. And so, again, that's really just a meeting, often only an hour and a half long, this time with the judge chairing the meeting.
Yeah.
And each party will say what it is that they want and why. Lawyer for child might have a view about what's in the best interests of the children. The judge will reality check at that point, which is a bit like what Rachel said a mediator can do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, reality check. The judge might say, well, look, you know, if I was hearing this today, if I was making the decision, this is probably the decision I'd make.
Right.
So how about you go and have a wee think about that?
Yep. Yeah. Okay.
So settlement conferences can be successful. You know, we often do get agreement at a settlement conference.
Yep.
It's the first time that the parties are actually sitting there with a real live judge in front of them.
Yeah, packing their decks. Yeah.
But if
stand up, sit down, stand up, sit down,
exactly.
You don't know what to do.
But if matters aren't resolved at that point, there'll usually be some discussion about do we need reports. The court can get a report from a psychologist.
Yes.
Okay. It can get a report from a social worker. Mm-hmm. It can also be cultural reports if that's relevant.
What about counselling services or something? Can they?
Yeah, there are still some counselling available through the family court. It was cut back a long time ago. We now tend to call it communication counselling or communication coaching.
Right. Okay.
And that will typically be ordered towards the end of the process if it's thought that getting the parties to speak to a coach basically about how to communicate with each other might help to make the arrangements work.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so that can be done.
Yeah.
But ultimately, if there's no agreement reached, you know, through that whole process, and that process, we're talking months and months and months.
Yes, okay.
Like
how many months?
Oh, well, it could be a year.
Yeah,
You'd hope that within a year you've established whether or not you're going to need a hearing.
Yep.
So a hearing is the trial, you know, we call it a hearing.
Yep.
And that is when each party will give their evidence sitting in a witness box. They'll be cross-examined by the other lawyer. They'll be cross-examined by a lawyer for child.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of that hearing, which could be half a day, 2 days longer, a judge will make a decision and will impose their decision on the family.
Okay. What then is a directions conference?
Oh, yes, I did skip that. That comes earlier on. So that is usually just 15 minutes where everybody comes together for the first time and says, well, this is what I think ought to happen and this is what I think ought to happen.
Right.
And this is the process I suggest, Judge.
It's often about scheduling and sort of giving directions for who needs to file evidence next or when that needs to be done by.
Okay. All right. So I think you've probably already touched on this, like the main factors that the family court considers when making decisions about the care and welfare of the children.
Yep, welfare and best interests is paramount, always.
Yeah, always.
And look, no parent comes to court saying, well, I don't care about my children's best interests. Mm. The whole point is that both parents believe that their position is what's in the best interest of their child.
Yes.
But they may need somebody else to actually decide what is in the best interest.
And would I be correct in assuming that the general ideal or the general principle or the baseline in New Zealand is 50-50, right? Like that's sort of where...
No, I wouldn't agree with that.
Okay.
Yeah. They had that as a baseline in Australian law and they've taken it away recently.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I think that's good.
If you were going to say, is there a baseline? Well, it would be that the children need to have a relationship with both parents.
Okay. Yeah.
And if there are no safety concerns, then shared care would be a baseline, if you want to use that phrase.
Yeah.
Shared care doesn't have to be shared 50-50.
Though. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And I don't like the focus on 50-50.
Yeah, right. Do you have thoughts about that, you two?
Yeah, I agree with Rochelle. I think if we're going to use the term baseline in the relationship property legislation, it's 50-50 as the starting point. And I think we've sort of almost veered into treating the children like property when we talk about 50-50.
Yeah, right.
And it's moving away from that idea that what's actually best for them. It's thinking about it as the parents' rights to 50-50, which is not always what's best for the kids. So.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. That's so reassuring to hear. I think that's wonderful.
And a really interesting perspective from you, Stephanie. Yeah. And I've not thought of it that way. But yes, it is treating the children like property.
Yeah, I'm sure it can feel like that.
I've got a case, I think it's recently finished, where one of the parents actually worked out how many hours per week they would have the child in their care and tried to equal out the hours over the year. And I just thought, nobody is doing that. No child is growing up and saying in their mid-20s, oh, my goodness, Mum, you had me for 74 more hours than my dad did.
Logbooks. Yeah, that's right.
No child
is
doing
that. The IRD is often looking at when it comes to child
that
support.
That is a question.
And,
how many hours
is
a week?
I think that drives the 50-50 idea
and
as
then
well.
I do know that you often have those situations where it is 50-50, but one or other of the parents are actually doing a lot more than that. And because it's legally been sort of set as 50-50, they have no recourse then for like more child support. And it may be just that they end up having the kids after school on the other parent's week or something, but they are then unfairly sort of, I don't know. It's, I think that's great if there's progress towards just what's in the best interest of the children.
Stephanie makes a good point. Sometimes that focus on 50-50 is coming from the child support thought.
Yes,
We have to, in the family court sphere, say, well, actually, child support is completely
separate. Okay.
You know, the calculations for child support will come after the decision is made about what care arrangement is best for the children.
Yes. Now, as I suspected would happen, we have got so much more that we could talk about and we're rapidly running out of time. So we were going to talk about litigation abuse, but I think we might have to bump that because it's quite a big, heavy topic. But just quickly touching on the idea of self-representation versus having a lawyer, what are your thoughts about that, Rochelle?
Look, obviously, I'm going to say you're going to be better off having a lawyer. We are the specialists. You know, I've been doing this for over 20 years. I do know how it works. You probably have never done it.
Yep.
I understand costs are an issue. So if costs are an issue, then it is possible to have what I think they call unbundled advice. So you have your lawyer on call to give you advice as each step goes through.
Yeah.
Please don't try and do it on your own without any legal advice, because you will just make a mess of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, how important are your children, really?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah. Yes.
I was just going to say the flip side of that, and this is probably the conversation about litigation abuse, but there are people who will self-represent actually as a form of dragging the process out.
100%.
To make it worse for their partner, or they don't believe that that they do need a lawyer. It's becoming a really complex issue actually in the family court and across all the courts in New Zealand, self-represented litigants. It's a really big issue. It takes up a lot of court time.
Falls into the litigation abuse kind of thing, really, maybe in some ways, because with unwittingly it probably happens. Yeah.
Yes, I think I suspect litigation abuse really only happens with self-represented clients. Yes. I would hope no lawyers are acting
right,
in that way.
Of course, yeah. So, look, thank you so much. And I hope that today's conversation has shown that there isn't just one pathway through family law. And some families can resolve matters through negotiation. Others will benefit from mediation. The collaborative process will be awesome for some. And ultimately, litigation is necessary to protect children or ensure fairness in some cases. So whatever stage you're at, understanding the process can make it feel much less overwhelming. So I'm very grateful to all of you for coming in today and helping to demystify some of that. So remember to ask questions, seek advice and support early on. Those things can make the world of difference. You've been listening to Harriet Moyer in conversation with Rochelle Crossman, Stephanie Pettigrew and Rachel Grant on Season 2, Episode 3 of Tell Me Moyer. To find out more about Rochelle, go to www.rochellecrossman.co.nz. Or Stephanie, go to marksandworth.co.nz, and Rachel, go to bluedoormediation.co.nz. Ka kite. You've been listening to Tell Me Moya, where the conversations with women are brave, bold, and occasionally make you clutch your pearls in a good way. Heard something that made you gasp, giggle, or immediately text your group chat? Don't worry, we've got you. You can replay this episode or dive into more colourful conversations at oar.org.nz or find us on your favourite podcast platform. For more information about my shows and shenanigans, follow me on Instagram and Facebook, Harriet Moyer Entertainer MC. And thanks to Rochelle Crossman, family lawyer, for her tremendous support of Season 2. Now, go on, hit subscribe. You know you want to.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.